send around and hand out what they can buy. They want to pass on. They want to pass on.
And there's more syllabuses up front. Syllabi. Syllabub. In the Antinomies, this is better. In the third Antinomy, Kant, which is the Antinomy on Freedom, contrasts the idea of the subject as known versus the subject as free or free and self-determining. And the thought is that this is the moral agent. This is going to be his so-called noumenal self. And Kant says, we don't know we are free. Rather, we must believe we are free. That it's not an arbitrary belief. It's not like you can decide, you know, to believe or not. It's a necessary belief, but nonetheless, it is a belief. It is a form of what he calls practical faith. So, there is a contrast between the empirical self that can be known in just the ordinary ways that people know about one another and know about themselves, and the free and self-determining agent who is unknown. And this is equally the distinction between theoretical and practical reason. Now, Hegel's problem with this is that this subject, the practical subject, subject of agency, subject of morality, is not only unknown, it is equally in a certain way given.
so that it is unknown and unconditioned, which is to say that the very idea of a free or moral agent is equally the idea of a new immediacy. And the idea of immediacy, you might say, is the very thing that Kant should not allow. The whole point of Kantianism was to say nothing is immediate, everything is mediated, and yet he struggles throughout his entire career, the idea of the fact of reason, all these different ideas, to try to understand this practical self. Hegel will avoid this problem in a multiplicity of ways, but the first and most profound way is to say that freedom and self-consciousness come to be, that they are not given, that they emerge through practices and through history, and that we can know them in all the ways that we can know any historical item, that there's going to be nothing particularly obscure about agency or practical freedom. It is going to be another way in which we know ourselves as historical agents, and hence in which we must affirm ourselves as beings of a certain kind. Now, what ties these critiques together of Kant is that he thinks that Kant did not complete his program. And he did not complete his program because, in a certain way, he remained an epistemologist. What does that mean? Well, epistemology is not just the theory of knowledge, but we'll say epistemology arises at a certain moment as first philosophy. That was what Descartes' revolution was all about, making epistemology first philosophy, by which I mean the issue became my fundamental relationship to the world is by means of representations. So to be in the world is to have fundamentally veridical representations of it, which is why, for all the early epistemologists, all the early modern philosophers, skepticism is so scary. Because if you believe that your being in the world is by virtue of representations of the world, and you don't know you can trust those representations, then you don't even have any surety that you are a being in the world, that you are, in a certain sense, worldless. Right? Hence, not only the moment of the first meditation, but even more radically, that moment where Hume becomes affrighted and he says, I am a monster, I must be mad, because he knows that the very idea of letting representations be our way of connecting to the world is a way of somehow disconnecting us from the world. Now, in a certain way, Kant's Copernican turn was supposed to resolve that problem, to be a theory of representation, but without the problem of whether or not our representations were veridical, because, right, the idea of the Copernican turn was, I don't have to ask if my representations match the world. The very idea of representations is already the idea of being in the world. That's the Copernican turn, right? The Copernican turn doesn't ask if my representations match the world. It rather suggests that to have judgmental representations of a certain kind is our way of being in the world. And you'll find the same thought, for example, in John McDowell. That's how I read McDowell. Well, Hegel is going to argue that our mode of being in the world is not fundamentally as knowers, but we might say as agents. Well, getting there, that is, overcoming epistemology, is the work of the opening four chapters of the Phenomenology. The first three chapters are a repetition of the history of epistemology, and the transition to chapter four in self-consciousness is to show that self-conscious agents are not related to the world as knowers, but by means of the strange Hegelian word that will suffer throughout the entire semester, by means of recognition. Not knowing, but recognizing. As if that's going to make anything better. Anyway. But we're in the world as knowers, not as knowers, but as agents, certainly his thought. Well, the turning point, what motors this movement into fundamentally overcoming the theory, practical reason distinction, and generating a philosophy which truly has a primacy of practical reason. Next week I'm going to argue that Hegel's ontology is an ethical ontology, that the very structure of his thought is governed by the structures of practical reasoning, not theoretical reasoning. So Hegel's gripe, I might say this is another one of his revolutionary moves, called the movement into pragmatism, is that we cannot understand our relation to ourselves and our relation to one another and our relationship to the world if we think of any of those relationships as fundamentally representational, that they're going to have a completely different status. And this is not to deny that we are knowers. It's just that, just to take a cheap shot, that knowing is a social practice. That knowing is something that is regulated by collective norms in which we validate certain truths and by means of certain practices and so on and so forth. That is all the thing that you are familiar with from post-Popperian philosophy of science, right? From Kuhn and Lakatos and all that kind of stuff. Well, the turning point that gets us on the way to this for Hegel is in the second edition, Transcendental Deduction. And the moment in the Transcendental Deduction where Hegel, and indeed even Fichte, think that Kant goes beyond himself is going to be in what is usually thought of as the turning point in the deduction, which relates to our knowledge of things in space and time. What Hegel and Fichte want to argue is that everything must be related to us. Everything must be related to us as self-conscious beings. If I can use one of Hegel's slogans, everything that is substance must become subject. Which is to say that there's nothing, no substance, no thing, no material, no item, no individual, no thought, no nothing, that doesn't get itself related to us as self-conscious agents. So that the absolute, he says, is as much subject as substance. in the transcendental deduction?
Well, let's remember how the transcendental deduction works, and this is the moment of great success. The transcendental deduction
fundamentally operates by trying to connect two claims. The first says that the I think provides, that squares are mean necessary, the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience. Kant's thought here is a rather easy one. It is that in order for an object to be known, it must be judged. The only way we can know things is by judging them. And if you're going to judge an object, you must employ certain judgmental forms. That is, judgment as a structure. So we use, say, you know, what? The table is brown. Subject-object. The couple in the middle. Well, if that's the way we judge things, and that's the only way we can know them, then that structure must itself, so subject-predicate form of knowing, must relate itself to the structure of things in the world. Right? Things, substances with properties or accidents. So that the structure of the world, Kant argues, must be, as it were, a material mirror image of the forms that we use in our practices of judgment. So if subject is predicate is your syntax, then we might say syntax entails semantics, or transcendental syntax entails a transcendental semantics. Okay, well, that's an easy enough thought, but it's also a subjective thought, because what Kant is saying is we think about the world how? Well, in just the way we think about the world, by using these forms, and therefore we must impose those structures, they must accommodate themselves to our ways of thinking. And that's the usual conceptual scheme problem, right? That things must accommodate themselves to the forms or structures of our thought. So the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience, those forms I must use, right, turn out to be these categories. That's the first step. The second step is to argue that the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience are also the necessary conditions for the objects of experience. That is, nothing can appear in space and time that does not conform to our structured ways of knowing. So the thought is here, in the first step, this leaves, let's call it, things temporarily outside our experience. Experience is just what gets shaped by our ways of knowing. In the second step, the argument is that things now must conform to our ways of structuring experience. Well, the thought then is, even appearing in space and time is subject to categories, where the categories themselves, all this stuff, right, derive from just are the structures of self-consciousness. Well, how on earth does Kant get from one to two? There's got to be a trick. How does he get from the thought that the categories are not just subjective conditions for representability, but further, that nothing is given in intuition can fail to conform to those categories? And it is remarkable that in this book of nearly 700 pages, the crux is in a footnote. It's the famous footnote at B160, which I apologize to all the students who did Kant with me last year, since you must be bored of hearing about this footnote. Kant says, space represented as object, as we are required to do in geometry, contains nothing more than the mere form of intuition. It also contains combination of the manifold, given according to the form of sensibility, in an intuitive representation, so that the form of intuition gives only a manifold. The formal intuition gives unity of representation. That must be nearly Greek. Right? The shift is from space as a form of intuition, as a given empty container that is wholly independent of self-consciousness, namely space as it is discussed in the Transcendental Aesthetic, to space as an actual object of cognitive awareness. But insofar as space is an actual object of cognitive awareness, it is a formal intuition and therefore subject to the categories. But that means if space, which is the condition for any object appearing to us, that it be in space, must conform to the categories, then lo and behold, everything that appears must conform to the categories. Therefore, the necessary conditions for the object of experience are also necessary conditions for the possibility of the objects of experience. In short, even the intuited manifold is determined by conceptual conditions. That's the crux of the matter. Everything, even the intuitive manifold of space and time, are determined by conceptual conditions. And hence, everything is determined by the spontaneity of the subject. Now, Fichte first, this is what his entire Wissenschaftslehre is about, and I always disallow any Hegelian students from reading the Wissenschaftslehre. It is a swamp. I have lost students in there. They have never come back. I spent all summer writing about Fichte, so you may have to come back to this. But anyway, in the Wissenschaftslehre, exactly what Fichte was trying to do, and certainly what Hegel learned from Fichte, was the recognition that the spontaneity of the subject, subjective agency, our powers, our ways of thinking, mediate anything that might appear to us. Now, what this does, if it's right, if this is the right thought, is it makes problematic the distinction, which is absolutely structural for Kant, between original spontaneity and original passivity. That's the fundamental structure of Kant's system, right? That it's structured by to know is to have intuitions, that you receive original passivity, and concepts through which you think, and that intuitions are synthesized by concepts. That presumes that there is an unsurpassable passivity, and the depth of that passivity is expressed in the idea of space and time as forms of intuition, that is, as abstract containers. If the argument of the transcendental deduction is right, passivity cannot be absolute or unconditioned. Passivity is always contextual. And this points to the deep failure in Kant. Kant presupposes the availability of space and time as forms of intuition in order to work from the categories to, say, the schematism to things, right? So he goes from spontaneity, mediated by the imagination, which then allows the categories to get themselves into the world by working up space and time. So what for Hegel, Kant's notions of space and time are empty forms. And the form that he thinks is most empty, and therefore the one he's going to struggle with most, is time. We think of events as happening in time. That is, Kant does. Hegel's going to argue that time is not a container. And he is going to replace Kantian time as a form of intuition with time as a contentful process. Let's give that process a name. History. Let's give history a name. Geist. So, what is, for Kant, the emptiest thing of all, time is simply a container in which events occur, becomes for Hegel the actual movement of history itself. And this, by the way, is going to be the crux of that chapter of the Phenomenology called, 26 weeks from now, Absolute Knowing. The chapter on Absolute Knowing is about the relationship between time as container and time as content. So it's a movement from time to temporality, from history to historicity. Well, once Hegel makes that move, that is, once you allow the thought
that nothing can be given, that nothing is a substance by itself, even space and time cannot be empty forms that get filled up with content, that everything has to be related to self-conscious agency, then the entire notion of our inquiry will be an inquiry into, well, what does Kant say about self-conscious agency? He says us moderns, as self-conscious agents, are self-determined. So the Hegelian notion of the investigation of the conditions under which we inhabit the world is equally an inquiry into the conditions in which we determine ourselves as agents in the world, or to use Hegel's technical phrase, an inquiry into thought's self-determination. So now you're getting that great Hegelian thought that the absolute is self-determining. Well, this sounds offensive. I know, and this course is full of offense. But look, I can see you were pleased with the idea that there was nothing absolutely passive. But if nothing is given, then there is nothing but the self-determinations of thought. This is another way of saying that there is no given. There's no object that's given that we're adjusting ourselves to, that we're trying to, as it were, think of us as absolutely outside us. If we're always thinking within the movement of thought, then we're thinking about the self-determinations of thought. So we are thinking that Hegel's philosophy is actually, which is what he says it is, a philosophy of freedom. That the nature of history is the discovery of the nature of the self-determining movement of reason, and therefore a unity of theoretical and practical reason. So what Hegel does by introducing this critique of the given is deny what can be argued to be the ultimate structure of all Platonic thought, and I take Kant to be a standard Platonist, namely the distinction between form and matter. By dropping the form-matter distinction, one equally loses a sharp distinction between the transcendental and the empirical, between the a priori and the a posteriori. If there are any a priori's in Hegel, then they will be, all of them, material. A priori, whatever the hell that means. Now, this will not mean, or at least Hegel does not think it means, that there are not any categorical conditions for knowledge, that there are not any categories. He did write a whole thing called The Logic. Rather, the claim will be that categories are uncovered or generated, they are not absolutely a priori, and that what is uncovered shows how the world must be. Well, how can I put that into a cheap takeaway slogan?
Well,
Hegel puts it in this cheap takeaway slogan, paragraph 20. He says, the true is the whole. That's pretty cheap. I mean, that just sounds like a tautology. The true could be the part. So he has to say a little bit more. Here's the more. But the whole is nothing other than the essence, whatever the hell that is, consummating itself through development. So the whole is what becomes. So philosophy is bound up with its becoming, and its becoming is ultimately the discovery of a self-determining movement. Of the absolute, it must be said, he says, it is essentially result. Now that sentence all by itself should tell you that whatever Hegel thinks the absolute is, you know it ain't the Christian God. Whenever my friend Stephen Holgate says to me, ah, yeah, yeah, Hegel's a real true Christian, I just quote him that sentence. And he flusters and blusters and points to a passage in the logic. And the absolute is a result, an historical result, that only in the end, only in the end, is it what it truly is. And that precisely in this consists its nature, to be actual subject, spontaneous, becoming of itself. Someone, a philosopher, I can't remember which, said, you know, become what you are. Of course, what else could you become? Something you're not? Now, in all of this, Hegel nowhere denies the premise of transcendental idealism. That is, to be is to be an object for a subject. I've already said, substance must become subject. An object is always constituted by a certain categorical set. I will argue, in 2 weeks' time, that this is the premise of the phenomenology. It's not even argued for. Hegel just takes this as a gimme. Of course, what is, you know, to be is to be conceived. What else could you be? Not conceived? Then you've conceived of it. I mean, you know, he just doesn't see a way around that. What the phenomenology does is examine all of the different concepts of an object that philosophy and culture to now have proposed. That is, the history of philosophy is a series of, we might say, what it is for something to be an object. So the history of philosophy is a series of concepts of objects, which is, right, crucial thought. Categories are concept of an object. So all philosophy is a series of concepts of an object. And each concept of an object entails thinking about a fundamental way in which we are related to reality. So every philosophy proposes a different concept of an object. Object is form, object is matter, object is life, object is self-consciousness, object is work, object is freedom. Each of these have their moment in the history of philosophy, in the history of culture.
what Hegel does is show that each of these are forms of self-relatedness, that they are ways in which we mediate our relationship between ourselves and the world. And therefore puts them in an order, and the order is complicated. The order of the phenomenology, which is both phenomenological and historical, but in a logical unfolding. Well, how does he manage to do that? There are two simple premises, I think, for his entire project. Premise one. There's a difference between modern skepticism and ancient skepticism. Modern skepticism cheats. Why does Hegel say that modern skepticism cheats in comparison to ancient skepticism? What's curious about modern skepticism? Say, yeah.
What's the
evidence of that? Hmm? Yeah, but why is that somehow cheap?
Descartes only gives himself reasons to doubt the external world. He doesn't give himself reasons on the other side. But one thing that was central to ancient philosophy was balanced out on both sides to achieve some kind of equilibrium.
So what is it that Descartes doesn't doubt, that Locke doesn't doubt, that Hume doesn't doubt, that Leibniz doesn't doubt? Yeah, their mindedness. What they're sure about is, of course, I have experience, but what I want to know is, does my experience, you know, represent the world? Right? So they keep the mind safe. Ancient skepticism does not keep the mind safe, but exactly as Adam says, seeks reasons to doubt everything. In short, we may say that ancient skepticism treats nothing as given and takes nothing as immediate. That everything is subject to doubt. Step two. What's another word for doubt? Let's assume that our fundamental way of relating to things is doubting them. It's a good way to start. We're philosophers, after all. We all know philosophers are mad. So, let's just doubt. What does it mean to doubt? What does it mean to doubt? What are you doing when you're doubting?
Question something.
Question? Good. Holding the names. Good.
Perhaps you can say you're doubling things. You're destroying unity. There might be different things. There might be this true. There might be another thing true.
Okay. And what's involved in doing that? Yeah? Critique? Ah.
Negation.
Negation.
Possibility.
Imagine possibility. The one that Hegel thinks is crucial is the idea of the negative. The negative. To doubt something is to negate it. To say, shall we say, no. Right? I mean, you know, the reason why, you know, if you want to see how much the French hate, right? Hegel, right? All you have to do is look at Derrida, you know, trying to be Molly Bloom. Yes, yes, I said yes. And he hates. I
I loved Jacques. He was no Molly Bloom. Paragraph 32 of the preface, and I'm just using little famous little bits from the preface.
Because they're irresistible.
Where should I start reading? But that an accident as such, detached from what circumstances it, what is bound and is actual only in its context with others, should attain an existence of its own and a separate freedom. This is the tremendous power of the negative. It is the energy of thought of the pure I. The pure I in its spontaneity is the negation of the world, is the saying no to it. Well, maybe there's another word for it. Hegel suggests it. Death. Death. If that is what we want to call this non-actuality, is of all things the most dreadful, and to hold fast what is dead requires greatest strength. Lacking strength, beauty hates the understanding for asking of her what it cannot do. But the life of spirit is not the life that shrinks from death and keeps itself untouched by devastation, but rather the life that endures it and maintains itself in it. It wins its truth only when, in utter dismemberment, it finds it. I had a drunken night like that. What moves the entire phenomenology is the force of the negative. And the negative is Hegel's, and this is the crux, his first definition of freedom. The first way in which we are free is our power to say no, to negate. So the power of negation is how we relate to the other. We relate to the other in the first instance by killing it. The simplest way of killing a thing, what's the simplest way? If you're a philosopher, of course. Not if you're a kid guy from the mob. Even simple, before you can deny it exists, you've already negated it. How?
Ignore it. Call it false.
Hmm?
Call it false.
Call it false. What if? What do you call it false?
No. I differentiate from yourself.
How would you do that?
That's the first thing.
What did Adam do? What did Adam do to get reality going?
Naming
it. How do you kill something? You give it a name. Because you've taken away its reality. Right? You interpose something between it and you. Right? So the simplest gesture, there's a whole essay, there's a whole story in Hegel on Adam naming and killing and all that. And we'll talk about that later in the semester. But even the simplest act of naming is a form of killing. You replace the actuality of the object with the name of the object. And then you have to work with that actuality, that name, because that becomes the concept. And therefore your relation. So the first thing you do, right, in coming to an object is to kill it. Judy Butler says, right, nothing is more terrible for a human being than it comes out of the womb and someone says, It's a girl. She says, that's fate. That's my death. That abjects me. Butler, of course, is a staunch Hegelian. She was making that claim in perfect self-consciousness of what she was doing. Now, take those two thoughts, that nothing is going to be safe from doubt, the privileging of ancient over modern skepticism. Second thought, that the consciousness or the understanding is defined by its negativity, which is another way of saying, by the way, there's no such thing as intellectual intuition. The opposite of the idea of the primacy of negation would be a belief that we can immediately intuit something without any mediating gesture. So the claim for the primacy of the negative is simply another way of stating the thesis that all thought is mediated, that all relationship to objects are mediated, and now we know what they're mediated by death. So this is going to be fun, right? Okay, now those two thoughts together, I want to say, are all you need for transcendental idealism. Because once you have those two thoughts, then you must claim that every relationship to an object is mediated by a concept of an object. That's the Copernican term. Every relationship to an object is mediated by a concept of an object in general. Taking the idea of concept and object in general, Hegel can then do what? Let's take a look. As I said, we want to defend idealism. Well, what's the opposite of idealism? Well, realism. What's realism? What is realism? Is there any definition of realism that would work in this course? Adam? Come on, you're working on this.
I actually don't know the answer. I don't have a good answer to that question. That the world exists independently of any kind of conceptualization of it that we might have. So there's a sum total of properties in the world that is fixed forever, and we need to go out there and find it out. But our own changes and concepts are getting closer to that world. They in no way constitute it.
Okay. And there's just one further thought that's necessary for our purposes. It's that something can either match or not match the world, and that there are no definitive criteria of that. So that the thought of a realist is if you believe that truth is representation, that is correspondence to reality, then you must equally believe that it could be the case that we have all the possible evidence we could conceivably have that the world is phi, and it be the case that the world is not phi. Right? That evidence and truth is always a gap. Right? And of course, the whole idea of the entire tradition was to try to find some way of closing that gap. So in Descartes, it's, you know, God's benevolence. As if God has nothing better to do than to make sure our representations match the world. What a tedious guy he must be. Kant, now you can see, tried to change the story. He said, let's not try to get over our things. Let's say that things must match our categorical representation. Well, that has all the problems that we have discovered. Hegel's strategy is, shall we say, to show the realist is false, not directly,
but indirectly.
Pippin, page 98. This is your one-page handout. That is, kind of fifth or sixth sentence down, fifth or sixth line down, that is the only strategy Hegel can use, consistent with his own idealism, will be to undercut the presuppositions involved in standard realist assumptions about being as it is in itself. That is, Hegel will try to undermine and exclude the relevance of such doubts progressively and systematically, rather than answer them directly. So he's not going to refute realism. He's going to tease us out of our realist intuitions. He's going to piecemeal by piecemeal. Now this brings up another kind of thought about what philosophy does. It's a kind of therapy. It's a kind of argumentative therapy in which we're shown that, well, what are we shown? Let's see what Pippin says and then we'll unpack it. He will try to show determinedly why, given some putative notional determination of objects, notional determination of objects means concept of objects in general. That's what notional determinations of objects is. Some broad categorical account of what objects are, right? He will show that doubts about whether objects must or even can be so notionally specified are the relevant determinant doubts. They are only as a consequence of that notion's own incompleteness. That is, the reason you can raise a doubt is because your idea of the conditions for knowledge has further conditions. So that all of philosophy imagines it knows what the conditions for knowledge are, that there be ideas, that there be universals, that I'd be in relationship, immediate relation to the objects, and it turns out every time anyone specifies conditions for knowledge, what Hegel will show is that there are further conditions for knowledge, and it's those further conditions that are the ground for doubt, right? So that the doubts are perfectly sensibly motivated in that respect, not general. Thus, this in turn means for Hegel, summarizing everything all at once, I'm glad he admits that's what he's doing, that such an opposition between subject and object is itself a determination of the notion. That is, the very thing that gets the whole problem going, there are subjects and there are objects, is one more categorical determination of concept and object in general. So realism, even its basic presupposition, itself is one more way of setting up the world. And so such an incompleteness can itself be made out only on the assumption of a developing notion of objectivity. There is no point, Hegel constantly remarks, in abstractly asking whether the world really is as we take it to be, whether for all we know this or that bizarre scenario might actually be occurring. Brains in a vat. And grown men, not 10 blocks from here, should think that this is the most important philosophical problem. Is bizarre. Didn't hear it from me. Doubts about the adequacy of our conceptual scheme must have some basis, a concrete ratio d'habitandi, for them to be serious doubts. And Hegel thinks he can show that the only legitimate basis for such doubts is what he calls spirit experience of itself, an experience itself determined by the developing notion.
So what he's going to do is show that all the reasons one would have for doubting, I can get back to where I started the lecture, the infinite, turn out to be part of the process in which we come to understand ourselves as spiritual beings.
And once we adequately understand ourselves, those doubts will not be answered, but become irrelevant. Hence, and this is all, by the way, Hegel means by absolute knowing, is that knowing is unconditioned. That is to say, there's nothing outside knowing, things in themselves, God, monads, all those creepy, crawly things that people keep, you know, forms. I remember once having an argument about Hegel with Stanley Rosen. And Rosen, of course, is a Platonist. And just, don't you get it? You first have to have an intuition of the ideas. And then he did what, you know, you wouldn't think a grown-up would do. He looked up. Stanley, there's nothing on the ceiling. There's a goddamn ceiling. You know, there are no ideas. You know. So Hegel means by absolute knowing, it was going to mean, I'm going to argue, not that we know everything, that would be an absurd claim, but that knowing itself is not realistically constrained. That there's no exteriority, no things in themselves, no God, no reasons for faith, none of these kind of crummy notions. In that respect, Hegel's philosophy completes Kant. Now, what might be thought to be more puzzling here is why, in order to think that thought, we have to talk about Greek tragedy, Roman law, the absolute state, capital, the French Revolution, Novalis's romantic poetry, get an account of Indian religion and Egyptian religion, not to speak of Judaism and Christianity. Hegel will try to convince you that those two involve fundamental concepts of an object, and that they too are part of the mediations of our thought, and therefore they too are part of our, oh, what's this book about? It's an education. It's a book whose conditions of possibility lie only in its end. Therefore, it is like a novel that is writing out the conditions of how the novel could be begun. So it's a version of Remembrance of Things Past. It's the portrait of Geist as a young
Okay. Now, I won't. Three quick things, and then I'll stop. They are just very quick. The ways in which even this deflationary reading of Hegel is different from standard readings of Hegel. First of all, ways I'll repeat. I do not believe that the phenomenology is presuppositionless. Since everything is mediated, so is the phenomenology. Therefore, there is no possible way of philosophy ever beginning. That's how the phenomenology begins. It begins in the middle. I'll have to convince you of that. Secondly, that the fundamental structure of the movement of spirit turns out to be a structure of ethical relations, so that, let's say, the ontology of spirit is an ethical ontology, and we'll look at the beginnings of that ethical ontology next week. And thirdly, there's often a question whether the phenomenology is a human comedy or a tragedy. It's clearly a narrative, it's a Bildung, it's like a Bildungsroman. I mean, we all know these questions. It makes philosophy into a certain type of narrative. Well, what kind of narrative? Is it a comedy or a tragedy? In part, I want to suggest, but only in part, at least some aspect of a tragic reading of Hegel is appropriate, for at least on the reading I'm going to offer you, part of the core of what Hegel thinks absolute knowing involves is the discovery of the disappointment in knowing. That in knowing, doing philosophy, we do not get all the things we hoped we might get. Philosophy does not tell us who we should sleep with, or who we should make war with, or how we can live a virtuous life. Philosophy is intrinsically disappointing. And to discover that is also so that what philosophy cannot do, and what often has been hoped for from philosophy, is that it should offer us a kind of transcendental security, that we are, the typical misreading of Hegel, at home in the world. I read Hegel suggesting the very opposite. That nothing can make us at home in the world. That's what people wanted from philosophy, and that was the mistake that drove philosophy to be forever a series of hyperboles, rather than, as philosophy must be, the recovery of the ordinary. Now, that would lead me to say, but I won't say it, that Hegel's dialectic is a negative dialectic. But I'll save that thought for another time. But it's not there. So for next time, we are going to read Spirit of Christianity and Its Fate. You should also read the fragment on love and the system fragment. I know you're not going to read all 150 pages, so since I know that, can I say that at least read the first 75 pages of Spirit of Christianity and Its Fate, and especially pages 224 to 238. And next week will be another introduction. So all of these are just ways of trying to find our Hegelian feet, to get a little bit spiritual in our life, and then we'll get serious in the world. Okay?
Good.